Delighted to welcome Dr. Anna McCready to today's seminar. Dr. Anna McCready is an associate professor in the School of Agriculture Policy and Development at the University of Reading. As a psychologist and registered public health nutritionist, she has a broad range of interests in subject areas relating to consumer psychology, behavior, and food. Her areas of expertise include health-related behavior change, personalized nutrition, behavior change techniques, consumer perceptions of sustainability, human cognition, and aging. Her current research is focused on two main areas, personalized nutrition and consumer trust. In the EU-funded Pan-European Food for Me study, she explored challenges and opportunities for dietary behavior change to develop recommendations for personalized nutrition services. And more recently, she took on the leadership of the large-scale seven-year EIT food-funded Trust Tracker project, researching consumer trust in the food system across 18 European countries. Her other work includes EIT food-funded research on household food waste and sustainable foods, and EU and FSA-funded research into the effects of foods and nutrients on cognition. So, a lot of information. Very excited to hear about her online study on personalized nutrition and dietary behavior change across seven European countries. So without further ado, please, Anna, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Today, I thought I would just cover three main areas. So what I wanted to give you was a bit of background on public health nutrition and where personalized nutrition fits into it. And then I wanted to talk about Food for Me project, which I worked on for 3.5 years. From 2011 to 2015. And I'll be talking about the study's aim, methods, and findings on personalized nutrition. And then finally, thinking about the future of personalized nutrition. So having a look at the challenges and the future prospects of it. So really taking it and putting it into the context of business moving forward. Public health nutrition. So at the moment, you'll all be very familiar with the Eat Well plate. Now, this Eat Well plate assumes one size fits all. The issue being that public health guidelines for nutrition are not really working awfully well. So diets may need to be tailored. They may need to be targeted to individual needs. And they need to be based person-specific information to do that. Let's just think about public health nutrition. First of all, is there a consensus on what we should be eating? And when you look at all the various food pyramids, Eat Well plates, etc., there's quite a bit of variation across different countries. So just, for example, even thinking about fruits and veg, now, we've got the five a day is our message. But, you know, in the US, it's eight or more or nine or more. There was even talk of it being 12 a day would be the right way forward. So there's no real consensus on what this public health nutrition rule should be. So when you're talking about one size fits all, there's disagreement on that. I think it might be a very good starting point to think about what is personalized nutrition. So how we characterized it in our study back in 2011, this was at the start of the Food for Me project, was personalized nutrition is healthy eating advice that is tailored to suit an individual based on their own personal health status, their lifestyle, and or genetics. What we wanted to do was we wanted to take a look at this to see whether we could use personalized nutrition to bring about behavior change. What I wanted to just flag up was another definition that I found recently. Now, this was a consensus. Personalized nutrition uses individual specific information founded in evidence-based science. That's similar to what we had before. But now we've got this extra bit to promote dietary behavior change that may result in measurable health benefits. Giving you a bit of a clue there as to how our research went, let's just have a look and see what difference could personalized nutrition make? We know that in terms of non-communicable diseases, 80% of premature heart disease, stroke, and diabetes could be prevented by diet and lifestyle factors. But the exciting thing for us here is that knowledge of the individual and knowledge of nutrient gene environment interactions could revolutionize the delivery of dietary advice, which could help lower any risk of chronic illness, such as cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancers. And it could also increase motivation to change eating behavior. Let's look and see whether the right diet matters. So here is a study by Nelson and colleagues. They took 101 women and they put them on one of four diets for a whole year. These diets were low carb, high protein, very low carb, low fat, very low fat. And they then got to the end of the study and they found that there weren't any real differences to get their teeth into, which was a bit daunting. But then they looked at the genotypes and they worked out that there were three genotypes. And they did this based on an array of genes. And they found that, that there was a genotype that was responsive to a low carb diet. And there was a genotype responsive to a low fat diet. There was also a balanced responsive. So then they took a look at the data again and they said, you know, is there a right or wrong diet for genotype? Interestingly, the correct diet was significantly more effective. So when they looked at things like change in body weight and they looked at the weight loss when the people were on the correct diet for them, they lost significantly more kilos than if they were on the incorrect diet. So pretty fascinating stuff. Then you look and you see, well, what about genes for obesity? Let's have a look at FTO gene. And this is the fat mass and obesity associated protein gene. 16% of adults who carry the risk allele weighed 3 kilograms more. And that's a 1.67-fold greater risk of obesity. Now, this is an observational study. It's not a randomized control trial. It is literally looking at the associations between one and the other. There was another study that looked at genetic loci for obesity, and they found actually 14 loci were associated with obesity susceptibility. 18 new loci were identified, were associated with body mass index. They also showed that a greater number of risk alleles were associated with higher obesity risk. So there does seem to be some kind of genetic basis where linked to obesity. How about for metabolic syndrome? They did a double-blind randomized control trial. It was a four-week intervention. For the treatment, they gave 600 IU a day of vitamin D3 versus placebo. And they found that the treatment actually reduced insulin levels by 15% and CRP by 54%. However, this only happened when there was, for those that had a low baseline vitamin D and higher adipokine levels. So what they did was they concluded here from that there was a phenotype responsive to vitamin D supplementation. So now I'm going to come to the Food for Me study. So what we did, this was a four-year study, 8.9 million euros, and it was funded by EU Horizon funding. It involved 25 partners across 12 countries. Most of them were the EU, but there were also, we had partners in New Zealand, partners in the States, and so on. Now, we had several work packages on business creation models, We had consumer attitudes to personalised nutrition. We had a randomised control study. We also looked at technology and we looked at legal and ethics. Now, our focus groups and questionnaire studies in the first place were done looking at business models and looked at consumer acceptance for personalised nutrition. And we explored those in 9 countries and we followed this up, having got the results, we followed that up with a human randomised control trial in 7 countries. We needed just over 1,000 and we got 1,270 completing. I wanted to just go through our aims. We had 3 main aims for this study. So our 3 main aims, the first one was to really explore the concept of personalised nutrition. We wanted to do this through a behaviour change intervention to work out what the feasibility of this new concept was. We also wanted to find out what consumers knew about personalised nutrition and whether or not they would accept this new concept. We also wanted to carry out a proof of principle human intervention study, because what we wanted to do was we wanted to identify key diet related genes and phenotypic measures, parameters. We wanted to be able to mimic internet delivered personalized nutrition service. And we wanted to do this with blood analysis and DNA home testing kits to see if those would also work. And finally, to develop an online dietary or physical activity assessment tool with algorithms, because with the idea that the technology was developing in that direction and would enable us to do it. Finally, we wanted to be able to recommend the best business creation models and to examine the future of this new concept and to develop tools, evidence-based tools for internet-based dietary advice. So how did we do it? We started off with the focus groups and we had a survey as well on consumer attitudes to look at the sort of the psychology behind those. We then did our 6-month, it was a parallel randomized control trial in 7 countries. We had 4 main groups. We had level 0, which was just receiving standard public health guidelines, you know, 5 a day, 2 to 3 portions of this and that, etc. And then we had the first level where they participants filled in food frequency questionnaires and we gave them advice based on that. The second level 2 was we gave them advice based on the food frequency questionnaire, but also on their blood markers. And in the final level, level 3, we based our advice on the questionnaire, their blood results and their genotype. We also asked them to wear a physical activity monitor for 6 months, which we thought would be quite challenging, but actually people were really good at complying with that. The other thing we did was we wanted to see whether the intensity or the number of occasions of feedback had any effect or impact on behaviour change. With one group, we just gave feedback on baseline, 3 months and 6 months. And with the high intensity group, it was baseline, month 1, month 2, month 3 and month 6. So how did we go about this? When I say recruitment via Facebook, this was very early days. This was 2011, 2012, and Facebook had sort of started in 2008. So this was quite early days. And but we thought, well, we'll try recruiting via Facebook. Certainly in our local centre, we didn't do awfully well by that one. We did much better with press and radio. Certainly in Spain, for example, they put out a press release and they were oversubscribed. We needed to get 235 participants per country, and they had 1,000 applications within 24 hours because the Spanish group was so excited about the concept of personalized nutrition. In the UK, it took us quite a lot longer. Now, we had home measures. So what we asked people to do was we asked them to take swabs, DNA buccal swabs at baseline. We also sent them these dried blood spot kits and asked them to provide us with these little cards with their bloods and to send them in. Anthropometrics, so height, weight, waist circumference, etc. Food frequency questionnaire, which I'll come on to in a minute. Dietary change questionnaire, which really focused on the barriers that they might have had to change their diet, to give us some sort of insight into the other things that were the non-food things that might be stopping them. And of course, the physical activity monitor. We emailed electronic dietary advice reports, but these had to be done by hand. And we gave feedback based on dietary algorithms, which I'll come on to in a second. We also provided an email and telephone help desk support every weekday from 9 to 5. So now we come to which genes did we actually test for and which blood markers? Well, we used 5 gene risk variants and we gave advice on, for FTO, we gave advice on body weight and exercise. FADS1 was advice based on omega-3 intake, TCF7L2, that's transcription factor 7 like 2, total fat intake based advice, ApoE E4, that was saturated fat intake advice, and MTHFR was based on folate intake. 4 blood markers that we focused on were cholesterol, which was about fatty foods, glucose, sugars, omega-3, fish oils, and carotenoids, which is, I'm saying mainly fruits and vegetables, because of course it does appear in things like shellfish, etc. How did we go about it? So you imagine you are the participant in the study. We would send you the link. We would ask you to log in and fill in your food frequency questionnaire. Now, this was adapted from the EPIC studies food frequency questionnaire and maps very clearly onto that and onto their findings as well. So we would ask them to put in what they'd eaten and their portion sizes, and then we would work out what they had actually eaten. Now, it's very difficult to see, but on the right, you can see that we've used a traffic light system to show what their lower limits and the upper limits should be. And for micronutrients, we also did this for macronutrients. We did this for exercise. We did it for in a number of ways. Now, for instance, take calcium. So if you have a look at the top, we've got the little man from our Food for Me logo and the person, let's say it's a person, and we have put that person, he appears on the amber band. So we want the participant there to improve their calcium intake by including more dairy products, as these are the richest sources of calcium. So that was how we did it. I'm just going to just very briefly take you through this graded approach. So we have the lower reference nutrient intake band, we have the estimated average requirement and the upper limit as well. So for instance, when you're looking at omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, then you would have those limits showing you, indicating to us where the participant comes on this continuum. Now, this will be difficult for you to see, so I'll just cover this very briefly. So our dietary feedback system, we developed this graded system for categorizing nutrient intake. And as you can see, little traffic lights flag up to us on our system the sorts of things that we need to look out for. And we were able to then use this to develop a system for prioritizing the top three nutrient-related goals for participants. We felt that more than three would be too many for them to focus on, so we just gave them the top three. And then we would identify the targeted advice that we needed to give them. From this, we also developed a decision tree with algorithms to link the data to on the nutrient intake to the feedback messages. So hundreds, literally hundreds of little feedback messages were created for each participant. We'd look up the correct algorithmic message and put that into their report. And then we developed these template feedback reports for each of the eight groups, or in fact, six groups who were receiving feedback. And that was for the delivery of personalized advice. And then we created a website, and also we used our Facebook page to be able to give people sort of updates on the project and how we were going, and exciting things that were going on in the field of personalized nutrition, and so on and so forth. On the website, we posted our publications, gave them all the information about us. So now you're wondering, what did we find? Our first finding was that personalized nutrition advice delivered via internet produced larger and more appropriate dietary behavior change than the people who didn't get any feedback at all, but were just given the public health nutrition guidelines. So that was really good. What we didn't find, any effect of frequency. So those people who had to do the very, very long food frequency questionnaire once a month for the first 4 months showed no additional improvement to personalized nutrition advice. And part of this was because what we were doing, building these manual reports, was taking us quite a long time. So it might take us 2 or 3 weeks to get all the reports done, by which time they were just about to be asked to do the next food frequency questionnaire. So that could have been down to our responsiveness or our resources. When we looked at do phenotype or gene-based advices, do these make a difference over and above the food frequency questionnaire based advice? And we found no, it wasn't more effective than food frequency questionnaire. But what we did find was that for specific genes like the FTO gene, which is a established gene for obesity, there were greater body weight and waist circumference reductions in risk carriers than in non-risk carriers. And for the APOE gene, personalized nutrition advice was more effective in reducing risk carriers' fat intake. However, the flip side of that was that disclosure of no risk for that particular gene did seem to weaken the dietary response to personalized nutrition. So those are really, really interesting findings. They weren't all the findings. We also, if you remember, did our focus groups. I want to remind you of those focus groups. Now, those focus groups, we did those before we started the human study. The conclusions that everyone was coming to was that no, definitely wouldn't do an online personalized nutrition study. Service. No, I wouldn't use it because we don't know who it is. Yeah, it could be some person who we can't see, certainly can't see down in the basement. We don't know if they've got any nutritional knowledge. We don't know how good they are at managing and storing my data. Is it going to be protected? So no, we would prefer a face-to-face service. So face-to-face provider is preferred. It is resource heavy. There are accessibility issues because you literally have to physically go somewhere, but it is confidential, or is seen to be more confidential. So the messages that were coming through was that online providers were feared. It was acknowledged that they were resource light, but they were acknowledged to be accessible. But there was always this whole thing about privacy, data privacy. And that was very important to the consumers that we spoke to. The conclusion is that had been given to us, according to what we were reading, was that web-based e-health resources were cost-effective, they're fast delivery, they're better access. So that was the way forward. So how do we then get people away from wanting that face-to-face provider and adopting the online provider advice? So I'm actually going to step out of the Food for Me project just briefly to have a look at trust and motivation and behavior. Now, this is from my other study. It wasn't related at all to personalized nutrition, but it was related to consumer trust in the food system. Thinking about personalized nutrition service providers, they are aligned with the food system. They are part of the food value chain because they link with it in terms of health. I've been sort of mulling over this as soon as I got your invitation, thinking about, well, can we possibly apply the same sort of thinking that we've been looking at in the food supply chain to personalized nutrition, or the concept and the idea and the delivery of it? Just to give you a brief overview of this particular study, this is the Trust Tracker study. It's been going since 2018. We've collected something in the region of 57,000 surveys since it started. So this last year we collected just over 20,000 in 18 European countries. We developed a model of trust, because this is really hard to find, you know, hard to define. You've got, you know, trust in an individual. And then here you've got a trust in a system, which is much more complex because it's made up of so many different actors, similarly to personalized nutrition. What we looked at, for example, if you see the blue box in our scientific model, we have beliefs about trustworthiness. So trust is seen to be made up of perceptions of competence, care, and openness, or transparency, if you will. That transparency, or the openness, we found was the one thing that really, it was the most crucial part of trust. It was the thing that actually drove confidence, people's confidence in their foods, the technologies that they were using, products and services and so on. And these beliefs in trustworthiness of particular providers actually mediates the relationship between motivation and intention. So motivation to eat more healthily, for example, intention to actually do so. And so trust helps to mediate that gap between changing, you know, yes, I want to do it, to I'm going to do it. So openness and transparency is critical. One of the findings that we had from our study, because we looked at consumer perceptions to farmers, manufacturers, or processors, retailers and governments or authorities. As you'll see, you don't have to be able to see this the bottom left graph, but I can tell you that authorities are bumbling along at the bottom. So the lowest white bar shows there is least amount of trust in authorities. These are the people who regulate, who come up with the rules, who actually enforce data protection, who actually enforce all of these aspects. So you can see that there are sort of synergies between the two projects there. Having blasted you with a whole new project in about 4 minutes, I just wanted to go back to personalized nutrition and just contemplate, just reflect on what these challenges for personalized nutrition are for the future. Now, I found Adams, who came up with the Adams and et al. He came up with the definition that I showed you right at the start, and what they discussed was that personalized nutrition approaches hold promise for public health in the future, but what's needed is more research. We need to know whether the dietary intake measurements are accurate. We need to have standardization of systems approaches. We need to have application and communication of evidence. So just to remind you, I mean, this trust in provider is incredibly important. And this comes up again and again in the literature with regard to personalized nutrition. We know that this openness or transparency is essential for confidence in products and services in relation to foods. We know that data privacy and data management, or the quality of advice, is also a challenge. Who actually regulates this or these things for personalized nutrition? There are also cost implications for members of society who would benefit most. So in this country, we have this expectation that the NHS is free, so therefore health provision should be free, and that may affect adoption or uptake of a personalized nutrition service. If it does have a high cost to it, then the people who really, really do need the additional assistance, the additional help, they're the ones who wouldn't be able to afford it. And finally, and this is the most important part of this, is that the evidence base is limited. We looked at, I think, over 100 SNPs, 100 genes, and we focused our study on 5 of these. So there are potentially other genes that people could look at. And it's possible that not knowing enough about these gene nutrient environment interactions could have influenced the efficacy of those kind of methods in and treatments in our study. So evidence base is limited. It draws largely on observational or risk association studies. So definitely more research and more regulation is needed. So I found, this is again from Adams et al, that group came up with 10 guiding principles for personalized nutrition. So I thought I would share them with you just at this point. And these are to define the beneficiaries, to use validated measures and methods, to really maintain the data quality and relevance, that's key, and to get recommendations from models that have been validated, algorithms that have been validated. So it's going to be data driven and evidence based. One of the others was to design user friendly tools to make it more accessible and, you know, like a pleasure to actually do these, adopt these services, and to align with population based recommendations, which can be tricky, as you saw at the beginning. Different populations will have different guidelines. And the last two, I think, are key. We need to communicate transparently about potential effects, the good stuff, the bad stuff. Consumers have so much more access to knowledge these days. They can go and look it up for themselves. So there is a greater expectation nowadays than there ever was before for transparency. Certainly when trust studies have been done in the past, transparency has been less important than competency for things like food safety. So this is something that has come about as part of a societal change. Protecting individual data privacy and acting responsibly, that is a key goal for the future. So talking about the future, let's just have a look at some of the opportunities there are for the personalized nutrition market. Well, the estimated market size in Europe is 42 to 93 million consumers, and its potential value, it was 8.1 billion in 2020, and it's thought to be to grow to between 19 and 46, it's quite a range, billion euros by 2030. Those socioeconomic shifts, those all important shifts, there is an increased focus on health and wellness. There's much better access to knowledge, and there is an increased demand for transparency, but also regulation. I've got Mike Gibney. He was the project overall PI. He said the complexity of a personalized nutrition business model and its strong link with societal change indicates that personalized nutrition will probably develop as a result of initiatives where public and private interests are combined. So it needs to serve both those kinds of interests. Now, costs. Well, for a full personalized nutrition service, these are estimated to be between 200 and 500 euros. That includes the follow-up, and about half of that is, you know, will be spent on diagnostics. We need integrated and validated science. So you need to focus on the nutrition aspects, but also the behavioral aspects, and really get a better understanding of the science behind it all. Different ways of categorizing individuals. So, for example, people have been talking about precision nutrition, which is slightly different to personalized nutrition. This is when specific illnesses, diseases are targeted by nutrition. So also new and evolving technologies. We've got good opportunities there, and to provide standardized automated feedback to reduce risk of inconsistency and error through the use of algorithms. See here on the right, we've got the eNutri app. That was a funded project that's actually ongoing at the moment, and that's also at University of Reading. But that is developed, that app has developed out of Food for Me. So nearly there, nearly finished here. Just to have a look at personalized nutrition services, their future in practice. So I found a few examples on the internet, on the web. So we've got, well, you've got genomics, you've got proteomics. So now we've got preventomics. Now, preventomics is actually a study that's looking at advising people on their shopping habits, you know, what to buy and what recipes to use. So we've got, you know, that's one type of example, targeting one part of the consumer consumption phase. Then we've got Noom. That's really focusing on the psychology aspect or the behavioral aspects of eating. In the bottom right, we've got your weight loss program type of application here. So helping people to develop sort of personalized or to lose weight based on more personalized advice. And the top right, that's the CRISPR project. This is, again, it's EIT Food funded. And it's, I think, University of Reading is working with Quadrum on this. So CRISPR seeks to validate the science. So this is more of a business-to-business organization or project, and it is there to provide personalized nutrition advice or service setup advice to companies wanting to be able to run a personalized nutrition service. So that is more of a sort of, it's going towards the regulatory aspect. It's trying to set standards in the field. So there are some ideas. I just always want to thank all the partners that I've worked with on both of those projects. So the bottom ones are the Trust Tracker project, and all the top ones were in the Food for Me project. And I'm going to stop talking now. So thank you so much for listening.